That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. It's episode 18. How you doing? You've had a good week? Been all right? Look, if it's been shit, my thoughts are with you. Because you know what? I ain't had a great week. But I do love Thursdays. I really do, honestly. And I hope you do too. Because this week, it's episode 18. It's Amanda Abington. And look, the great thing is about doing this podcast, right? I get to sit down with people one-on-one. And whether they're, like, friends of mine or not, but I get to make it all about them. And, like, you can go down the pub or go for a cup of tea or a cup of coffee down Costa or Starbucks, wherever you go. But when do you find the time to do that? To sit down and make it all about the other person? You don't. But on here, that's what we do. And I'm thrilled with the people that come on and chuffed that Amanda found the time and we could make dates work. Even though it was half term and it was difficult for all of us, we did it. And it's fantastic. What else have I got to tell you? Oh my God, the reactions to Michael Balogun last week were overwhelming, not just from, like, from our side, but Michael got in contact with me and couldn't believe the reaction. But I kind of knew after I left home in Manchester where we recorded, and I remember saying to producer Griff, I mean, this is just going to go off. And it really did, you know. Still now, up till tonight, people are still texting and emailing about his story and his positivity and the path that he's on. Bless him. He's a lovely, lovely guy. And thrilled that he felt safe, that he could come on and tell his story on our little podcast. Brilliant. Anyway, enough of my waffling. I'll do a bit more of that at the end. This is episode 18. Of the Two Shot Podcast with the brilliant Amanda Abington. I hope you enjoy. Thank you. Perfect, this is brilliant. I thought they were really good doing that sound check, actually.
They were, yeah, they weren't bad.
Do you know what I'm going to do first?
Go on.
Are you going to do that?
Yeah. Shut that door.
Shut that door. Get that door shut.
Because it just gets a bit...
Shh.
It just gets a bit noisy with that traffic outside, and
this is lovely. But this is where you do it, right?
Sometimes when we're in London, we would do it in here.
It's lovely,
and because my friend Tanya owns this place, and down here in the daytime, no one's here.
Yeah, that's
so
great.
So she gives us this little space.
How lovely!
And all we've got to deal with is all that road work across. But that's London, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But you're never going to get away from that.
Were you born in London?
I was born in North London, Edgware.
Edgware?
Yeah, so just on the fringes of North London. And I've always been a North London girl. I've always, I've never gravitated east, west or south.
You've never tried it? Never dipped your toe in?
No.
I did, because I, when I came down from Blackpool, I immediately went to North London, because that's where all the Northerners were.
Yeah, right.
And I went north, south, east and west. And
did
then
you?
Went straight back north again.
Yeah.
Having...
I do like North London. There's a kind of, I don't know, there's just a... I don't know. I don't know whether it's because you've got Hampstead Heath. You've got a lot of greenery in North London, whereas I don't know if you'd sort of... Yeah, I'm just like, you know, like sticking to where I know, I guess. That's what it is.
And what was growing up in Edgware like?
Well, I was born there, and then we moved to Finchley. And then my parents moved out to Hertfordshire. So I've always been, like, on the boundary of Hertfordshire and North London. It was lovely. It was really nice. When we moved to... Hertfordshire, I mean, I must have been about five. And then when I got to my late teens and early 20s, I moved back into North London, sort of Finchley and then Crouch End and Ali Pally.
They always end up in Crouch End.
Always end up in Crouch End. It's an act, it's the mecca for actors, Crouch End.
I know.
And pop stars as well. There's a lot of kind of singers, songwriters, yeah. A lot of indie boys used to live in Crouch End, I think. Like, you know, Travis lived
that's
there.
That's right. I always used to see him in Banners.
That's right, yeah. That's, you know, because there's a table that Bob Dylan sat at in Banners. Bob Dylan used to go to Banners.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I do know that. Someone did tell
Bob
me.
Bob Dylan sat here. It was like, like loads of kind of Bob Dylan fans come and sit and...
And was it just you growing up? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I've got no one. It's just me.
Don't say that. I've got no one.
I've got no one. Yeah, it is. It was just me. And I've got such a small family. I've got my mum and dad, my auntie, my cousin and his wife and their two kids, and then like three estranged cousins that I don't see on my dad's side, and that's it.
So apart from the estranged cousins, was it, even though it was small, was it quite a close-knit family? You're all very close.
Yeah. I mean, I lived with my grandparents and my mum and dad growing up. We all lived in a big house together, and that happened till I was about six. So there was always my grandparents in the same. They lived upstairs and we lived downstairs. I was really close to my grandparents, properly close. Like, more close to my granddad than, I suppose, my dad growing up, because my dad worked a lot, so I didn't see him, whereas my granddad was around.
What was your dad doing?
He was a photographer, and then he worked in kind of photo finishing, kind of setting up laboratories and things, so he was always kind of... He was in the Grunwick disputes, like the 70s kind of...
Right.
All the disputes that were happening around that time with, you know, Thatcher and everything.
He was
involved in all that, and so I didn't really see him much, whereas my granddad was more present, and so... It just turned out that I'd spent more time with them than my dad, which was weird, but, you know, make up for it now because he's around a lot, my dad.
He's retired now.
He's retired, and my mum, and they spend a lot of time with the kids because being a single parent is kind of, you have to juggle work, and the work-children balance has to be quite... has to be quite precise.
Yeah, especially so at half term.
It is, yeah, and any holidays, really. So my mum and dad are very present at the moment.
And they're still there? Are they in Finchley?
No, they're Hertfordshire.
Oh, Hertfordshire.
They've moved, because I moved back out, and they're like a minute down the road, which is so convenient at the moment for me, because I get to go and work in Manchester and then come back. And
yeah.
There's a lot of juggling, Craig, a lot of juggling. As you know, because you're an actor and you get it and you've got kids, it's not feeling guilty about working either. And it's the same, it applies with men as well, you know. That whole feeling of kind of being, do I take this job because I want it but I've got to kind of be a parent as well. It's, you know, it's a bit of a minefield, I think.
The guilt factor is funny, isn't it? Because it does creep in.
It does. And I think it applies with men as well as women. I think women feel it more. I don't know, you know, when I speak to mothers who work, especially in this profession, there is a stronger pull of like, oh, God, what am I doing? You know, I've got to take this job, but at the same time, I've got to be here as a parent. Whereas I think, you know, talking to fathers, I think it's much easier to kind of just detach yourself and go off and work for a bit. And I don't know what that is. I don't know whether it's because we carry them. I don't know what that is. But there is a different guilt.
But that's a bond that we as fathers will never have.
Yeah, you have a different bond. It's a different one. And I think, you know, I was talking to Martin about it, and it's when they get older. I think that's when fathers really come into their own, I think, because they need the kids need that male inspiration, I guess, and that male kind of support.
And do you think you had that with your granddad? Was it did you see him much more as a father figure than a sort of grandfather, or?
No, actually, no. He was always a grandfather figure. And that, you know, I always loved my dad, and my dad, I knew my dad was my dad, and which is just that he wasn't. And I think because also it was the 70s and the 80s, and that was, they just weren't, they didn't have to be present as much, you know.
It was, oh, God, no. I mean, my dad used to go out to work, and then he'd come home at 5:30 and it's tea time, and
You've
got an hour and a half of something, then it's bed.
That's right. Yeah, and but now there is a pressure for men to have to do that as well. You know, there is that, you know, you have to be there a lot more and you have to kind of do all that as well.
Of course.
It's definitely changed.
And what was school like when you were growing up?
It was okay. I didn't really like school. I was bullied quite a bit as a kid. I had a really bad time at primary school. Yeah, I didn't have a great time. I hated it, and for about 3 years I was really bullied, and didn't want to go to school, and didn't tell my mum for a bit. So it was horrible.
Who did you tell?
I told in the end I told my mum because it got unbearable, and I couldn't. I would be crying every morning about and not wanting to go in, and she was like, "What's the matter?" I said, "These girls are making my life horrible, mummy, and I don't know what I'm going to do." And they keep saying, you know, if I tell anybody, then something will happen to you. And yeah, it was horrible.
Was it physical or?
It got physical, and it got towards the end. It got physical. I'd get pushed around in the cloakrooms, and my stuff would get stolen and hidden, and they'd take my packed lunch, so I didn't have anything to eat, and things, just things like that. And now I think back, I think, oh God, you poor little girl. You should have, you know, you should have spoken up, but. And I didn't for a long time because I was scared, you know.
Of course.
You're scared of
a lot of people. A lot of people don't speak up.
No.
When
so now I am fiercely aware of anything like that. I become very kind of militant about it. I watch these two like a hawk, you know, my two kids, like about them being decent children and not and calling bullying out. And them knowing that actually you don't treat people like that. And actually you have to be the good person and be nice and be kind.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, when you see your children playing like with their friends and you are watching them if they're in your house and you're looking after the other children.
Yeah.
And if you see your child behaving
I'm straight away.
Yeah,
I am
me too.
Out. You don't do that. And I'm, you know, and I, with them, I'm all about the manners and all about, you know, I don't care how you behave with me in the house. You know, we can have like a different dialogue. You know, we can muck about. But actually, if you're in other people's houses, then I want you to say please. I want you to say thank you. I want you to be, I want you to talk to adults. I want you to be able to talk to adults and have a dialogue with them. I don't want this kind of monosyllabic no please and thank you. I'm all about the manners, and I'm all about just being a nice, bringing them up to be decent people within society. But they can, you know, we swear and do all sorts of things in the house when it's just us, and they know the difference, and I think that's important. They know they are getting values, I think. They're learning about what's right and wrong, and I think that's because I had a terrible childhood in terms of school. I hated it, and I hated going to school, and I hated that, you know, because I felt very, always felt on the outside at school. I was never part of a group of people because I was never made to feel welcome, you know. I was always kind of, and I don't know why. I don't, you know, I think because I always tried to maybe be over nice with people and try and, you know,
try and fit in,
ingratiate myself to people. And actually, that's just like, no, but I, so I'm well aware, I'm aware of them being decent people and making sure that they are people that adults want to hang out with. Do you know what I mean? That don't go, oh God, no.
Well, there's nothing worse than those sort of, as you say, sort of monosyllabic.
Who don't go, yes, please, or
yeah.
I'm like, what? Come on, mate. You know, that's just page one. That's manners. That's just being a decent person. Please and thank you. Doesn't cost anything. It's and that, you know, I see that now when I'm working. You know, people who just kind of don't, who, on set, who just take stuff and don't say thank you. I'm like, really? Are we going to, this is the way we're behaving now, is it? That you just...
What, they've just brought you that coffee and you're not going to say
see,
thank
I
you?
Find, I get really cross with things like that, Craig. I really do. I find it really, Maybe I'm being over the top about it.
No,
but
I don't think you are.
I just think, you know, that's just page one of being a decent person is just acknowledging that somebody's done something for you.
And they didn't have to do that.
No, they didn't. And the fact that people... I find it a lot, you know, I do find it a lot working on set that people just take stuff and I'm like, oh, okay. It's interesting that you didn't even acknowledge that person and you were too busy texting someone on your phone. Okay, that's... But that for me is like the measure. I then get the measure of that person. I think, oh, okay, then.
Well, it speaks volumes about that person.
I think it does.
Because I've got a bit of a thing. Do you know when you queue up and you go and get your dinner, you go and get your lunch?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if a runner or a third goes, come on, come to the front. I say, no,
yeah, that's what I do.
All these people are all crew. They've been here before me.
Yeah.
I've been sat on my arse having little breaks. Mm. They haven't.
Yeah.
No one's going to starve. We're all going to eat.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm like. That's what
That's
what I do. Because I just, you know, nobody's more important than anybody else on any film set, I think.
No.
Because if you didn't have the grip and you didn't have the makeup artist and you didn't have the essays, you wouldn't be making that thing, you know. Well, everybody is equally as important.
You can tell those sets where you're not an ensemble.
Mm. And yeah, you feel it. And the hierarchy.
And there's zero complicity between everybody. And you go, oh, God, yeah, exactly, the harmony isn't there. And there's an imbalance.
Yeah, there is. And it feels, you don't feel safe in that environment, I think. You just feel a bit like, oh, well, you know, somebody's more important than anybody else. I've never really understood that, especially in the job we do, especially, you know. Just because you're number one on the call sheet, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're doing anything more important than somebody who's just made a great big rig to light you.
It means absolutely nothing.
It really doesn't.
in the grand scheme
of
things.
Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, also, we're telling stories. That's it. You know, that's it. You know, we're not going into war-torn Syria. Do you know what I mean? We are telling
and
stories.
And we're all doing it together.
And we're all doing it and we're trying to make the best of it and make a decent, whatever it is we're doing, whether it's theatre, film or television. You're all working towards like a common goal of making something that people want to watch. And I think if you have somebody who's just this ego that comes in, it imbalances the harmony, I think. And you automatically go, oh God, I'm dealing with an arsehole. Okay, all right. And you have to deal with that now as well.
It does reflect in the work at the end of the day. Because even if someone watches it back and they would say to you, oh, well, I didn't see anything wrong with that. You go, well, you know what?
I can't watch it
because that's left such a bad taste in my mouth. All I've got is the memories of when we actually did that.
Mm, and how difficult they made that.
Yeah. Whoever it is.
Whoever it is, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I love a harmonious set and I really try and strive to make everything I do as enjoyable and as happy as possible.
But I think that shit bleeds down.
It does.
From the top.
It does. Yeah, I think so. If you've got somebody... whoever it is who's leading that cast or crew, who is easy and joyful to work with, you can't help but it's infectious. It is,
and it ceases to become work.
Mm-hmm. It does. It becomes just this beautiful thing that you get to do and get paid for.
We just go out to play.
Yeah,
that's all
but that's what it is.
That's what we're trying to do. You know, we're talking about children before.
Yeah,
and we've spoken about this loads on the podcast that. Children don't judge.
No, they don't.
They're not there to monitor themselves or, you know, close anything. They're just open books and they just want to play.
That's precisely what it is. But that's why we do our job, I think. It should be why we do our job. It should all be about the play.
Mm.
And it shouldn't be... I think if you layer on kind of whatever neurosis you have on it, it just becomes a task. Then it becomes an ordeal. do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you don't want to get up and do it anymore.
And we've all been there.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Really. And you really have to steel yourself and go, okay, I'm going to do this. I know I'm going to do this. We're going to get through it. But it is. It's a weird machine, I think.
So when did things, if they did, when did things turn around at school?
When I went to secondary school, it kind of got better. And I still got more confident as well when I got to secondary school. And I was away from the people that were doing it. So I could kind of start again with a fresh palette.
Clean slate.
Yeah. And so I went in and I was like, okay, I'm going to...
Reinvent myself.
Yeah. And just be less scared. You know, I was a very nervous child and I was very shy and very insecure. I mean, you know, that's... there's always that there, you know. That's part of being, I think, being an artist as well. You know, there's that insecurity.
Yeah, completely.
You know, you're constantly kind of going, am I okay? Is this okay? Am I all right? You know, you're constantly checking yourself. But I think I just went into secondary school going, right, okay, I'm just going to have a nice time. And if anyone does anything to me, I'm going to have the courage to kind of say, no. And to kind of stand up for myself. So secondary school was a lot brighter for me than primary school. And I had a nicer time.
How were you academically?
It was okay. I mean, I do what they do. I mean, the potential was there apparently, but I just didn't apply myself.
So many school reports.
Yeah, she's got a very good sense of humour. She likes to make the class laugh, but she needs to apply herself more and be more focused. That was the general thing throughout my whole secondary school.
If only they put the effort in for their work than they did making people laugh.
Yeah, but that's what it was. That was like just a... Every single school report was like that, I think, you know. And, of course, my mum and dad didn't care. They didn't. They were like, it's fine, you know. Because they kind of knew that I wanted to... Because at that point I was dancing. I was doing ballet a lot and I wanted to be a dancer. All through my secondary school, that was what I wanted to do.
Was this all extracurricular?
Yeah. So I started ballet when I was five and loved dancing. And I thought, well, that's what I want to do. And then when I got to 16, when I left school, and I got my GCSEs, you know, I got nice grades. I mean, I didn't really work that hard, but I managed, you know, I passed them and I got some. But I was going to a theatre arts school in Epsom. I'd already got in. So I was like, it didn't matter. Fine, I've got a place there, so it's fine.
And this was to do dance?
Yeah, purely dance. And then when I got there, I sort of realised I wasn't happy. I didn't enjoy it fully, and I got a very bad...
Why do you?
I realised when I got there that actually I was surrounded by these amazing dancers, like proper.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, I'm not that good at this. And that's what it felt. I was like, oh, no, I'm quite crap at dancing. That's interesting, okay. But I was doing drama at this place as well. They had little drama classes every week, and the drama teacher was like, This is good. You should think about this. This is what you should do. You shouldn't do the dancing. You should probably knock the dancing on the head and maybe focus on drama, because I think that's where your talent lies, and why don't we pursue that? So...
Did it take the fun out of dancing for
you? Yeah, it did. I was like, oh.
God, that's such a shame, though.
Yeah, it is. But also, I was upset about it, because I thought I was a good dancer and actually I wasn't. You know, and you suddenly realise, oh, that's what it is.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm actually not that at all. So that's annoyed me slightly. And then I got an injury anyway. I went down into splits and didn't warm up properly and ripped all my groin. So that put pay to it anyway. I mean, that was like whatever. That was the last nail in the coffin of my dance career.
Did that put you out of action?
Yes. Yeah. And what that did is it fueled my. Pursuit of drama, I think, and I thought, well, I'm gonna do that now, because there was always, you know, whenever I speak to actors, they've always, during their youth and their childhood, were kind of making up plays to make their parents watch them, and would tell jokes and do funny voices, and I that's like
impressions,
absolutely, yeah. And I'd always done that, and so I thought, well, I can use that, so. And then I auditioned for, because by the time I knew I wanted to do acting, it was too late to audition for places like Lambda and all those, you know, RADA and all that. They'd already shut down. And because I'm quite impatient and won't wait for anything, I thought, well, I'll just audition for this little Hertfordshire Theatre School place, which was up in Hitchin. And it was tiny. And I got in.
And how old were you now?
I was about 18. And I met this amazing... He was the principal of the drama school, called John Gardner, who was this playwright and teacher who he taught drama at Rose Bruford and things like that. And he was such an inspiration. He's, you know, he was my biggest inspiration. He was amazing, and he kind of mentored me throughout my 3 years there. And was just really very philosophical about acting, and would say, you know... You might not ever work, and you have to prepare yourself for the fact that you'll probably do a lot of theatre and education, and you'll probably make your own work, and it won't come easy, and don't expect to be
some overnight sensation.
Yeah, and work at it and be scrappy about it and don't give up when it feels like at the 11th hour that this is never going to happen. Just don't give up. If you really love it that much, you have to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it.
How did you feel when he was telling you that?
Well, I kind of knew that anyway. You know in your heart when.
Yeah, I suppose if you're honest with yourself, yeah. You go, this ain't going to be
I'm
a
never
walk
gonna,
in the park.
Yeah, I'm not going to be Meryl Streep. Although there's a little angel on your shoulder going, you know, there's a little thing here saying, you're not going to be Meryl Streep. But there's another side saying, well, you might. So
yeah,
you've got,
what if,
you know, it takes one job. So I had that kind of thing anyway. I mean, I defy any actor to go, no, I wouldn't want a BAFTA. It's like, of course you would. Of course you would. You don't do it. You do it because at some point you'd like to have a BAFTA.
You want a nice pat on the back.
At some point you do. Of course you do. You know, that doesn't drive it, but there is always at the back of your head going, well, no, I'd quite like one of those one day.
Awards don't mean nothing.
No, but except when you get them and then you go, oh, my God, you know. So, you know, there's that duality of, like, I want to be famous, but I don't want to be famous. And, you know, the part of, you know, the normal part of you goes, no, I'm just going to do it for the work. And then there's another part going, no, I really want to be famous. I want people to think I'm brilliant and award me accordingly. But so I always kind of knew that it would be hard.
But and how were those 3 years there?
I loved it. I mean, it was a weird place. It was a really weird place because it wasn't a conventional drama school. It wasn't accredited. So we kind of did what we wanted. And, you know, in my year, there were 8 girls and 1 boy, and it was all a bit strange. And but the teachers that would come in and teach us all this different stuff were great. And John Gardner was this amazing man who just was this little kind of oracle of all knowledge and was very interested and interesting. And, yeah, I mean, he was the reason why I stayed there, really. And
it sounds like he was very honest.
He was. He was always very honest about it, and he was always very brutal about it as well. You know, it might not happen. But if you love the work and you love your job, keep doing it. And I always did, you know. I remember meeting Martin and I'd been working up until that point. Then I met him and overnight just work dried up. Didn't work for 18 months. And I was like, wow, this is good. How am I going to deal with this? And so I changed agents and nothing really happened. And I don't know how I got through it, actually. I can't remember. But I just remember thinking, I'm not going to give this up. I'm not going to, because I love acting. And then all of a sudden I got an audition, I think, for... Maybe it was a play up in Scarborough, or I got a thing. Maybe it was I did a 20 Things to Do Before You're 30, which was a kind of 6-part comedy on Channel 4 with Matt Horne, and Jane Fallon produced it, and it was Tiger Aspect, and then that happened, and so I had this work, and then it started to happen again. So it was like just as that moment where you think, oh, I'm not going to do this anymore. It does. It can take one phone call.
During those 18 months, did you seriously ever consider, right, enough's enough?
Probably not seriously consider. I did, you know, I do stupid things like, well, I'm going to be a midwife then. I'd had those kind of things. I'll be a midwife. I'll apply for a midwifery course. And I think I remember kind of Googling or writing to the University of Hertfordshire and asking for a midwife application form for their course. And then just looking at it going, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to wait a little bit longer and see what happens. But there is something, you know, it's frustrating. That's what it is. It's because you want to work and you want to be in a rehearsal room, or you want to be on a TV set or in a doing a lovely radio play or something. And it just becomes painful, actually. It hurts because... You think, well, I can do this. I have, you know, I have worth. I think I'm a good actor. So why am I not working? Why is everybody else getting those jobs that... And there's nothing you can do about it. You are completely at the mercy of people that pick other people.
And it can eat you up, though. You know, it's quite dangerous.
You have to develop a really tough exterior and tell yourself that it's not personal, because it's not personal. If you're a good person and if you're a nice person to work with and if you have a modicum of talent, it's not personal. It's all about taste.
Yeah.
And it's all about fitting in to that, whatever that character breakdown is. And also, you know, it's you're not the only one that they've turned down. There'll be seven or eight other people that it's... Which took me a while to work out, you know. I'd think, oh, it's just me. They've just turned me down. But, of course, they see about 9 or 10 people for that part. So 9 other people are doing the same thing I am, of going, oh, God, it's me. It's just me. I'm a terrible, you know. And it's not. It's not that. It's purely personal.
Yeah.
It's purely, you know, what they need. It's nothing to do with you or...
It's not a reflection. It's not on a reflection,
no. Or your ability, I don't think.
Although at the time...
At the time you think it is,
you obviously think it is.
And it eats you up, it does. You know, I would get really upset when I didn't get jobs. I mean, I would take it really personally and have a little cry and then, you know, cancel and continue and move on and try and pick myself up. But you do take it personally. And you have to steer yourself and train yourself not to, because it's actually, I don't think it is. I don't think it is. And I think the older you get as well, the more philosophical you just go, oh, okay, that's another one I didn't get. Fine, let's move on.
Chalk it up.
I think you do, though. I mean, I do. I'm certainly less... It upsets me less when I don't get a job now. I'm like, okay, fair enough. Didn't work out.
Because your priorities change, I suppose.
They do. And also, you know, you realise... You know, I think it's when you have kids as well. You do change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everything shifts when you have kids because you have to be selfless. So you can't think about yourself all the time. You can't be all about, it's all about me, because you've got little lives that you have to mould and shape and be responsible for. So that feeling of selfishness takes a back seat in everything, I think, including your work.
Because it ceases to become about you.
Yeah, I think so.
And were your parents supportive?
Very, always. Yeah, always. Always. My mum was like, you have to do act. You have to be an actress. That's what you're really good at it. And I have faith in you and you have to do it and don't give up. And it'll happen eventually. And
yeah. Keep at it.
Yeah. My mum was all about sticking at it. And so was my dad, actually. He's, you know, they're both really proud. It's really lovely. They're both really... And like, they've never not, you know, they've always been, keep doing it. Don't give up.
I was talking to somebody yesterday about when you're going for an audition.
Mm-hmm.
And they've started to leave it in the room.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's quite a hard thing to do, but I think it's a really brilliant thing to do, because otherwise you're carrying it around with you.
Yeah.
And the weight of it really does drag you down in every sense.
It does.
Are you good at leaving stuff in the room?
I wasn't. I am now. Yeah, I am now. I'm much better at it now. Five, 10 years ago, I'd be sitting on the tube going, why didn't I do that? Why didn't I do that? I should have said it like that. Why didn't I do it like that?
Rewinding, going back over it.
Yeah, replaying it all the time, all the time. And now I'm like, okay, I did the best I could do. Because I prepare stuff more, you know. I am more likely to read the scripts and work on it more than I did before.
But I think that's part of the business that's changed as well. The preparation has become, I think, much more like America.
Yeah, which I'm not keen on.
Everything has to be off book.
That annoys me. I have to say that annoys me.
The thing is, I went into an audition not that long ago, actually, and they said prepare, and I always do. And I caught the director out of my peripheral, not even looking at me, just looking at the script. So I went, oh, what is this, a sort of line learning contest?
Yeah.
And then she had the audacity to say to me at the end, fantastic, really humanised that.
Wow.
And I felt like, going, you didn't even fucking look at me.
Wow.
You didn't even.
Did she not?
She didn't even look. And I'm not saying that. People have to fawn over you, but at least let's work on this together.
Look at what I'm doing. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And not look at me, but just...
But engage.
Look.
Engage. At least engage in the room.
Yeah.
In the room. Be present in the room.
I'm here.
Yeah. I've turned up and I've learnt this shit for you. And I don't have to, because I haven't got the fucking job yet. That's the thing that really, that sticks in my craw, is that you're expecting me to learn 14 pages of dialogue And I haven't even got the job yet. And it's like, that's a lot of my time that I have to take up on the off chance that I might get this job. Now, yeah. I'd rather go in with a sense of the piece and be confident, because also you're finding your lines, you're thinking about your lines as opposed to being performing it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you know it and you can be doing this, you can play with it more. And then if I get the job, yeah, I'll learn anything you want. I will learn anything you want. But actually, I don't want to be nervous about forgetting lines that I've learned on camera for you. I'd rather have it in my hand, and then we can play and you can direct me and we can... Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I just think it's... I don't... Yeah, because auditions are nervous in... You know, they're nerve-wracking enough as it is. I mean, you're going into a room blind with people that you probably haven't met before, and you're trying to get a job, and it's nerve-wracking. The fact that you've had to learn 14 pages of dialogue and remember that and try and find a character and work with people that, you know, casting directors, and I just find it's too much pressure for... God, it's too much pressure for an actor, but I just think, you know...
Give
them a break. Just give actors a little break and let them have the script in their hand and not be totally off book.
But do you feel it has changed?
That has
been a shift, especially in the last 2 years,
yeah,
I feel.
Yeah, be off book. Really? Well, and of course, you know, the indignant side of me goes, no. No, I'm not going to do that. No, fuck you. No, I'm going to go in with the pages and say I've had a really busy day and I've tried to learn it, but actually I've had to do all this as well. I get really scrappy about it, which I shouldn't, but I do. Because I just think, no, you can't expect me to do that. And of course, you know.
They do.
They do. Because it's the way of it's the nature of the beast and how it's changing. And it's unfortunate because it just. I had a friend who's an actress, and she's got two kids and she's a single parent, and it was like 7 o'clock at night, and her agent rang and said, listen, darling, you've got this amazing job's just come through for tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And it was like 20 pages of dialogue with big monologues. And she was like, what do you expect? And she said, well, you need to be as off book as possible. It's like, I mean,
how do you expect me to go in and do a half decent job?
Yeah, because something has to be sacrificed, and it'll be your performance if you're trying to find the lines.
Yeah.
It always is. It always is.
I know somebody, and I won't say who it is, didn't get a job not so long ago.
Mm.
And the reason for not getting the job was they weren't off book. Which I found...
Oh, no. You see, but that just makes me... cross.
Yeah.
Because if that, then it's not about the job. It's about.
There were other people who were completely off book.
So, but that's the, you know. So, so
what was that, mother?
Yeah. Did you do a good performance? Yeah, you probably did. They probably did an amazing performance. But.
But
you didn't learn it. So sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is it now?
It's not about the work,
thing.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's about your ability to be off book in less than 24 hours. It's a different thing. Oh, it makes me cross. It just really does. It makes me cross. But it's, you know, as I say, you know, we have to do it, I guess.
Do you, in the downtime and the sort of dark periods, do you keep creative or do you shelve that and focus on other things?
Yeah, I do. I shelve it now. I mean, I'll read, you know, I'll read plays and things and go to the theatre, but I don't focus on... Yeah, I don't go to classes and I don't, you know, keep my oar in. I don't do that. I kind of just, I do the family stuff and do that.
The important stuff.
Yeah, the relevant stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, because then I find, you know, when you go back to acting, when you go back to it, you can come back to it fresh. And you always come back to it with a slightly different, I come back to it with a slightly different outlook or you know, because... I learn from life. You know, you learn from it. You take everything as an actor, you know, from working, you know, I can pick stuff up from my kids and I can pick stuff up from just walking along old Compton Street. You know,
you're constantly observing.
You know, I think as actors, you have to take everything in. You're like a sponge and you just absorb everything and you can use that in whatever job you go on to next. So it's not all consuming. I love my job and I would never do anything else. And if I couldn't do it again, it would break my heart. But it doesn't rule my life.
Do you think that's something that has come with time?
Yes.
Because when we were talking earlier, when you were starting out, you're very impatient and you kind of want it. Now it's, things have mellowed a bit.
I think so, yeah. And I think that's also, you know, at the moment, I'm in a nice position where people go, oh, it's you, oh, we like you, we'll have you in. And that's, the shift has changed. So there's not this, you need to know who I am kind of thing. Because people go, oh, Amanda, no, yeah, we like her or we don't like her. Or, do you know what I mean? So there's there's been a shift in my, I don't need to pursue it as much.
Oh, show you who I am and what I can do.
Because people sort of know now. They go, oh, yeah, no, we know her. She's done that, and that, which is great, and we love her. So, or we don't, you know.
And either way, you know, if they don't, that's great, because it's great we shouldn't be working together.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So there isn't that you need to be, it's me, you know. In this country, I mean, I don't, you know, I think in America they go, who? What? Nah, I'm not really an American commodity.
Well, you know, for a lot of us, that's just like starting again.
Yeah, and I don't have any interest in that, I don't think. I mean, if you know, I like working here. I love working in England. I really do. I think we make really good stuff, and I think I just love our work ethic as well. We have a really good work ethic
here. Yeah.
It's great. I'm working with Michael C. Hall at the moment, and he's saying, you know, it's a really good, you have a really good balance of, you know, like in America, they'll just work and work and work until it's done till 4 a.m, whereas here, we, you know, we finish at 7 and that's it. And then you go home and you can, and he kind of loves the way we work here. He thinks it's really inspiring and interesting and healthy. It's healthy. We have a healthy way of working here.
I think so.
I love it. I love it.
Amanda, that was so lovely. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there we go. How brilliant was that? She's just ace. Just dead honest and tells it like it is. And I love spending time with her. And I hope you enjoyed it too. Thank you so much for subscribing. And a massive thank you to you, right? I don't know if you know, but in The Observer last week, they've got a section, a new review section. It's an arts section. They had a special. It was about the podcasts of 2017. They had a top 10, right? Who was in the top 10? The Two Shot Podcast was in the top 10, right? And that is all thanks to you, because you hit subscribe and you rate and review us and you give us 5 stars. I mean, honestly, I'm flabbergasted. And I know producer Griff is really chuffed to bits. And we're a bit taken aback, to be honest. You know, we started this at the beginning of the year, just a couple of guys. We did it all from our own pocket. And the fact it's connecting with you all means a really big deal. And also the calibre of people that come on the podcast. Yeah. It's just incredible. Long may it continue. And it will. Next week, episode 19. And it's... yeah, I'm not going to tell you who it is. You'll find out, because you're going to follow us. We're at Two Shot Pod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. If you want to drop us an email, let us know what you think of the show. We love hearing those too. I've got to do that. I've got to do a big list of reading those emails out, and I will, I promise, before the year is out. It is twoshotpod@gmail.com. Until next week, take care, keep warm wherever you are. If you're somewhere hot, keep cool. I've been Craig Parkinson, he's been producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Have a good week. Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.
Mmm. The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.